The market is still awash, with optimists and pessimists all trying to decide exactly when, or if, deal-making will return to normality. But to make that happen, the direct lending community needs to be on board. What is lenders' approach to financing across the different size brackets, especially as the large cap segment is still struggling to deliver exits? How are lenders changing their relationships with sponsors as they seek to protect their downside risk? And how are sponsors themselves organising debt solutions and leveraging their portfolio? Hello, this is Rachel Lewis, Senior Correspondent and Head of Auctions with Merger Market. And to help answer those questions, I'm joined by Josh O'Neill, DebtWire's Head of Private Capital. Before we delve into the topic, many of you will know me as a regular guest on this podcast. However, our wonderful host Harrier is now away on maternity leave, so I'll be out holding down the fort and keeping things running smoothly. In the meantime, we've got a fantastic episode already lined up for you today, so let's dive straight in. So with that, I'd like to welcome to the podcast for the first time, Josh O'Neill, who is Head of Private Capital at DebtWire. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks a lot for having me, Rachel.
So as I said in the intro, this podcast is about how the lending environment is impacting private equity deal making for the next few months. And as we look into 2025, but I really think that we should start off by talking about the M&A pipeline over the coming quarters and into the beginning of next year. Really focus on the size of the deals that are coming through. Because I think, and you know, this is quite an interesting statistic from my side. The biggest exit that we've seen in Europe this year happened all the way back in March, with Permira's partial sale of Ultidomus for Cinven for just shy of about 5 billion euros. Now, we've got a few more large cap exits upcoming this quarter. We've got Sanofi's consumer health carve out as a potential buyout, and Stada as both an exit and a buyout in the pipeline at the time of recording. But, you know, these are multi-billion assets. So, Josh, I really want your opinion on whether you think large cap is buoyant at the moment and how lenders are viewing that kind of space if they're willing to commit to these kinds of deals.
So from my view, from the lender's perspective, the pipeline is a little bit of a mixed bag right now. I would say that in the mid-market, we haven't quite seen as much flow come through in this quarter as many had expected. I think the eternal optimists on the buy side of the market have always had a very different view of what H2 would look like compared to lenders. Lenders are natural pessimists. They're all about protecting their downside, and therefore their view is very different to those operating on the buy side, who rely on deal flow to print their money. So what I think is played out is we have a bit of a mixed bag in terms of assets that have hit the mid-market pipeline. Small cap pipeline, there's a few things, but I would say that there has been a healthy amount of flow that has come through in the large cap space in September and is expected to come throughout the rest of the year. With this being said, there are a number of processes that were set to come in the fourth quarter of this year that are now being pushed to Q1. I think speaking on behalf of the lending community, particularly direct lenders and private credit providers, I would still say there's fairly low levels of conviction. And what I mean by that is that lenders are killing deals earlier than before. They are not interested in kind of wasting any time showing face in processes merely to keep sponsors and advisors happy and, you know, take stuff to initial LIC only to kill it and knowing they were never going to do the deal anyway. Instead they're being very targeted and they're only pursuing transactions on which they have high levels of conviction. To me, this is indicative of a somewhat challenging market for exit still. You know, in the UK, we've just had interest rates held this week. There's more promising news on that front coming over from the US, where the Fed has cut rates by 50 bips. And this will certainly ease certain underwrites, especially US dollar underwrites, and also help bring some conviction to the European and UK markets. But again, to go back to my initial point, I still think there's limited conviction among lenders, more generally speaking, and they are just being extremely focused in the processes that they decide to pursue.
Interesting you say that, because my next point was going to talk around auctions as a process and how competitive they are and kind of where lenders are going into the process. I was speaking to a lawyer earlier this week and he said that one of the changes he's seen at this point in the year compared to last year is that we're now seeing a lot more bidders, particularly at the early stage. You know, obviously, as it gets later towards binding offers, it does still drop down to two or three. But 12 months ago, you only had one, two, three at the beginning, and now you've got six or eight. So, you know, where are lenders fitting into the auction process? And if they are becoming more competitive, does that lend itself naturally to there being more conviction in a sale, or still not, from your opinion?
I don't think so. I think that's where there's perhaps a little bit of a disconnect still between the sponsor side of the market and the lender side. Certainly what I'm seeing, if we look at the mid-market as an example, again, to go back to my initial point, you know, lenders are taking quite a quick view at the moment, you know, some even at the teaser stage as to whether or not to pursue a business. If you dial back to the headier times of, say, 2021, when lenders were extremely keen to deploy money in sort of 0% rate environments, and let's say when lenders were a lot more risk off, you know, a lot of lenders were swimming around every process. They would take a lot of stuff to several ICs. They would really kind of race to at least show face in a process. And I'm just not seeing that very much at the moment at all. I think to your point about a larger number of sponsors engaging in processes earlier, I think that is probably a sign of, you know, there's a lot of dry powder that needs to be deployed. And that's just going to be a natural point of inflection whereby sponsors can't sit on that money forever, right? And we have been in a pretty challenging environment for some time. So I think, you know, you take the multiple factors of that need to deploy capital. You also then take the narrowing gap, which is finally narrowing, I might add, on the valuation side. And I think sponsors are more willing to engage on processes perhaps than they were sort of 12 months ago on the time frame that you said. But from the lender side, I'm kind of not seeing a huge amount of widespread conviction still. Again, you know, it's a lender's job to protect their downside, right? They don't have the same mandate as equity providers. They're not looking to capture upside. They want their money back and then with a premium in the form of a coupon. So they have very different mandates. And I think when you actually look at the rate of defaults that are increasing, you know, some companies have a very high level of debt burdens that they simply can't manage. We've covered a lot of key takings this year, and I'm sure we'll see more of those. Perhaps that's something we could come on to later in the conversation. But I think, you know, there's perhaps a sense of cautious optimism on the equity side of the aisle, while there's still a little bit of reticence on the lending side of the aisle. And I think that that chasm will take a little bit of time to narrow and correct.
Okay, so talked a lot about downside risk and lenders wanting to protect themselves. How are they doing that? And again, just to follow on from a conversation I was having earlier in the week, I think one big change I've noticed and that we've been talking about for a while is EBITDA adjustments. Speaking to the CEO of a large mid-cap private equity fund, who was telling me that, early period of 22, the average adjusted EBITDA was around about 25%, and now it's much closer to 5%. Is that the main way that lenders are taking on, well, protecting their downside risk, or are there other things as well?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the ways in which lender side documents are structured, you know, let's stay in the small and the mid cap space, and then we'll come onto the large cap space because they're very different. You're right to say that EBITDA adjustments and the aggressiveness of them, there's not as widespread as an acceptance as there once was in the sort of headier times of the market. I think in the small and mid-cap space, lenders have a lot more flexibility to push back against sponsors that are trying to be aggressive on these documents. Also, they have stronger protections, arguably, in their covenants, right? So again, I keep going back to this period of 2021, but we did see some pure mid-market deals there that were done on a covenant-light basis, and that was a relatively new phenomenon. And to me, it was very much indicative of a 0% interest rate environment, right? Fast forward to today in 2024, and I haven't seen, to my knowledge, a single covenant-light mid-market deal this year compared to in the previous years where I'd seen several. So I think lenders are, you know, again, have been sort of much more risk on in that sense. in the sense that they would definitely want to see a covenant in their deals, and that's one way of protecting their downside so they can actually enforce if they had to and a company breaches covenant. Aside from that, you know, talking about EBITDA adjustments, again, that'll be dependent on a deal by deal basis, but I would say consensus among lenders in the small and mid cap space has changed. And there's definitely less appetite and less willingness to let sponsors sort of move the goalposts on that front. However, looking at the large cap space, it is a very different picture. Now, when you look at a large cap private credit deal, you know, the size of some of these funds now, we've had Goldman raise $21 billion. We've had HPS raise, you know, close to that. We've had Ares raise over $30 billion all in the first half of this year. So there is a hell of a lot of money floating around in private credit at the moment. And again, they are under deployment pressure. And the size of the transactions that this market can handle now is much more akin to the syndicated market, where looser terms are more widely accepted. You know, the syndicated market was largely born in the US, and the US is much more used to aggressive terms being pushed on lenders by sponsors. A lot of that is trickling over into the European market now. So what you do see for most deals in the large cap space and the private credit side is you see pricing is a lot tighter. You know, pricing now for, you know, a high quality asset of, you know, let's call it a large cap unitranche deal will probably price between 475 bips over to around 525. That's kind of where the market is for a decent quality deal now. Anything with a little bit more hair on it might go up to 550, but that would be considered, you know, quite high pricing now. If you look back to around a year ago, that status quo was at around 625. So again, we've seen massive tightening in the large cap space. And again, on the covenant light front, that is the status quo.
This is a bit of a tangent. I was at a conference a few weeks ago and someone said that in the large cap space, the private credit funds, their lending's almost become a bit commoditized. They're competing merely on pricing. And you mentioned the pricing there, whereas in the mid-market it is a lot more relationship driven. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, you could argue that in the small cap space, I think relationships matter a lot more. I think even the mid-market now, especially in the UK, is becoming very commoditized. If you look to more localized markets, smaller markets like the Benelux, France, DACH, Nordics, relationships do matter a lot more there. Where I would say relationships matter most between lenders and sponsors are when deals go south. So that might be when you're, you know, organizing a restructuring behind closed doors. That might be when a lender is threatening to enforce on a business that's breached its covenant. And, you know, do they decide to give the sponsor breathing room to work out that asset and perhaps bring its trading up to a bit of a firmer level so that an enforcement is not necessary? On the large cap space, you know, a lot of these lenders, it is very, very highly commoditized. They are money printing businesses. They, you know, there's a queue of them. If a lender decides not to do a deal with a certain sponsor, you know, you can almost be certain that sponsor, if it's high quality credit, will have a line of lenders round the corner waiting to do that deal. So, yeah, I think in the large cap space, they can deploy money faster and in a larger volume. But at the same time, you know, they take a bit of a haircut on price, and they take a bit of a battering on terms and the documentation as well. In certain instances, not all, but in certain ones for sure.
Listeners, I promise we are going to talk a little bit about debt for equity swaps in a few minutes. But for now, I just want to narrow back in on the M&A pipeline. Josh, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that we're seeing a lot of deals being pushed out to H2 next year. And certainly on the M&A side, which is my area of expertise, I've started noticing really long periods from mandate to launch. You know, I see this on two sides, mostly, you know, sometimes to do with making sure that the due diligence is done properly and thoroughly, but also because of the drop in valuations, although it's narrowing, as Josh already mentioned, sponsors are kind of actually waiting for longer for the bottom line to grow, so that even if the eventual EBITDA multiple might be a little bit lower, they can still reach the valuation that they need. But Josh, I'm just wondering, on the lending side, is there anything, you know, I know you've done some work around portability, about how sponsors are best positioning their companies for exit before they launch?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a little bit to unpack there. So I'll start with your point on trading. Yeah, I think that's largely correct. I think both on the sponsor and the lender side, particularly on high growth businesses that are promising the world and being, you know, very heavily pro-formed or heavily adjusted and looking towards a very aggressive forward-looking figure. I do think there's a general consensus in the market that, you know, some of those adjustments are just not going to be taken as gospel anymore, whereas they once were. I think both lenders and sponsors want to see sound trading for a certain period, and they certainly want that trading to be vindicated by the financial due diligence when the time is right, mid-process. And I think any sort of skeletons that come out in the closet in that respect can be detrimental to a process. I mean, anecdotally speaking, and we've reported on several of these, but, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of these processes fall over for exactly that reason, right? And, you know, it does often take another 6 to 12 months, perhaps even longer in certain cases, for that trading to come back. And therefore, for there to be a high enough level of conviction for that business to come back to market.
I've got a good example of this, actually, which I wrote down. So we reported on Radex, which is a Gilder healthcare company, back in late 2022, which was initially marketed off around 25, 30 million EBITDA. But there was a lot of disagreement in the market from lenders and bidders because actual reported EBITDA was 13 to 15. So it kind of basically doubled in the adjustments. So at that point, a sale didn't materialize. But it did come back in late 2023 with around 18 million on the docks, so more towards the lower end than the upper end. And then in March this year, it did sell to two parties, which was Swiss Life Asset Managers and Vespa Infrastructure Partners. So yeah, case in point.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, if you looked at that initial 30 million figure, then the people who raised the red flags were probably vindicated on that one, I'd imagine.
But what about the portability? I know... let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a couple of points on portability, and I'll speak a little bit about the run-up to what often leads to portability. So, again, going back to the challenging environment that we've been operating within for the past, call it 12 to 18 months, you know, depending on how optimistic your view of the market is, a lot of these sort of paused, put on ice, failed, fallen over sales, whatever term you want to use, have pivoted to refinancings. Not usually, but quite often, a sponsor will look to exit the business, and that will correlate strongly with when the debt maturities are due for that business. So two birds, one stone. However, if that sale falls over and the business still has a need to refinance, and that still belongs to the incumbent sponsor, it is the responsibility of the sponsor to refinance that debt. So what we've actually seen a lot of is failed sales or poor sales actually pivoting the refinancing processes and quite often retaining the sell side advisor if they have debt advisory capacities to actually advise them on that process. If it's a larger cap sponsor, they may well have a capital markets team that would oversee that refinancing directly. So if you've had a poor sale or you've explored an M&A or an M&A process, or you even, you know, you kind of soft launch a process but didn't fully launch it, you didn't get the appetite you wanted and you pivot into a refinancing, but you still plan to exit in the sort of near to midterm, call that 12 to 18 months. We're seeing a stronger ask now from sponsors for portability and the documentation underpinning that refinancing. And the way in which portability works is that any new lender or lenders that come on are willing to accept a white list of sponsors to which that business can sell and then port the debt over to that new sponsor. So you don't actually trigger a change of ownership under the documentation, and it helps streamline a sale. So again, for some of these businesses that maybe have a bit of a hangover effect on them from the, you know, potentially a failed sale, portability does help that business get over the line in the next attempt at a sale if there is portability in place, because it gives the next sponsor conviction that the financing is there, it's in place, it's ready to go. All they've got to do is be able to pull the trigger on the equity side.
And is it only in those instances, or are you seeing anywhere they've got a genuinely good asset for sale that hasn't got that hangover?
So the other instance in which this would occur is merely for a holding period. Perhaps the fund would be at the end of its life cycle, or it has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that there's been a failed sale and they just need to refinance it anyway. However, let's say the sponsor is 5 years into the hold and it requires refinancing. logic would suggest that sponsor is going to think about exiting that in the next 12 to 18 months anyway. So why wouldn't they put portability in again to help facilitate and streamline the ease of a sale going forward?
Yeah, it's really interesting on the Laps deal point. I was just checking merger market, and in the UK alone, we've got nearly 150 companies that we count as missing in auction. So quite a number. What opportunities does that present for the direct lending community?
Well, it would depend on the quality of the asset that's missing in auction, frankly. You know, I actually had a pipeline call earlier this week with a lender, and we were running through a bunch of names that had been on both of our lists for a long time, and kind of wondering where they'd ended up. And I do often get asked by the lending community, oh, do you know whatever happened to this process? Most of them are missing in auction, or they were in the first or the second round, then suddenly went quiet. So, you know, I think the lenders do look, in some ways, actually, what's quite an interesting point is that the direct lenders they're almost operating a little bit more like private equity firms, in the sense that they are originating and trying to preempt processes, be that a refinancing or a buyout, before it's actually fully in play. So if you think about direct lending and the history of it, you know, this was always a commoditized sector, a commoditized industry. Most direct lending shops were structured that everyone working within them was a generalist, not a specialist. But actually what we're seeing now, particularly in the bigger outfits, is a trend towards specialization, and actually people working within these direct lending outfits having sector specializations so that they can proactively reach out to sponsors and say, hey, look, I track this sector really closely. I notice you have this asset. Its maturities are coming up. I'm aware there's not a refinancing right now, but, you know, we would be here if you want to have a conversation about it. That is much more akin to how a private equity firm has historically operated, right? Private equity firms, the best deals for them are typically off market. It's typically they're not getting the best value for money when there's, you know, maybe 10 to 20 other sponsors sniffing around the same deal. So I think in the same way that private equity firms have historically moved away from, or have tried to at least move away as much as possible from, sell-side led processes to finding off-market opportunities, direct lenders are very much doing the same and aligning their origination efforts with that.
Here's a question I've never thought of before, so I'm genuinely interested in your opinion, if you have one. We know that hold terms are lengthening in private equity. Is there a similar pattern in the lending? Are the lengths of the loans becoming longer?
Not that I've seen. I mean, a typical unitranche maturity would be 5 to 7 years. So in theory, it would cover most cases for a whole period, unless that whole period was beyond 7 years. But I mean, that would be relatively exceptional.
Okay, we've talked about live deals, we've talked about lapse deals. But now let's take a longer view on the next 2, 3, 4 years. We've actually got the expert in the room with us. Josh published the industry's first deck for equity report a few months ago. Everyone keeps talking about the upcoming wall of maturities. I am personally very interested in the 2021 vintage that deployed very fast and very hard in a low interest rate environment. Josh, do you think we will see more sponsors forced to hand the keys over to lenders?
Yeah, it's certainly a controversial subject, depending on who you speak with. So look, the report that we published covered the period from 2018 to 2023, and we unearthed more than 61 debt for equity swaps that had been executed by European credit funds in that period. Those are the only ones that we are aware of. Of course, there will have been more. I mean, this year already, since the publication of that report, I believe we've unearthed at least another 10, perhaps more than a dozen key takings, as debt for equity swaps are often colloquially referred to. Look, I think, again, this is reflective of a high interest rate environment, right? We quite literally had a scenario where we went from 0% interest rates to, in some cases, over 5% base rate. All of these direct loans are pegged to the base rate. They are floating rate instruments. They are not fixed rate coupons. So if you imagine you were an issuer, you were a private equity owned company that was paying 0% base rate and let's say a 6% margin on its debt. If you suddenly take the base rate up to 5%, your debt repayment is almost doubled, right? You're now in the double digits. Now, if you're already skirting on thin margins, that is very, very problematic and has been for many companies which have ended up breaching their covenants. And as a result, the lenders have stepped in and forced and taken the keys. Again, I made the point earlier in the conversation, but here in the UK, interest rates have been held again. The US, they've came down, but they're still very high and continue to be high across the Eurozone. I think there's been a lot of delayed pain. And by that, I mean, there's been a lot of amendments and extensions that have actually allowed sponsors and lenders to sort of kick the can down the road, so to speak, on the potential problem children in their portfolios. That, depending on who you speak to, again, this, you might get the view that this is them simply buying time. And eventually, if something is a bad business that can't sustain its debt, it's not a matter of if, but when. That scenario will play out.
And do you think sponsors are generally being more conservative with leverage across their portfolios, or are they managed to juice it with new things?
I think it depends on the sponsor and it depends on the business, right? I mean, if you've still got a software business coming to market that is high growth, has this high margin, can sustain high levels of leverage at the senior level, they'll certainly be at the right appetite for that from the right funds. Other instruments that have increased in popularity over the past 12 to 18 months, when we have seen not only a valuation gap, but also a general downturn in leverage appetite, is payment in kind facilities. These are deeply subordinated junior credit instruments. They are not secured at the company level. They are secured at the holdco level. So again, they essentially allow a company to pay its interest with more debt and accrue that. So they're quite a risky instrument, but again, they can allow a sponsor to get potentially another two turns of leverage on a deal. And in many cases that can actually be make or break for a process. So yeah, again, you know, for the right kind of businesses, you'll always have that sort of risk appetite. But it's very much horse of the courses.
Yeah. And I think just to kind of bring us back to the beginning of the conversation and round things off a little bit, you know, making or breaking a process on the debt side, those are kind of the things which might be necessary. But I think on the equity side as well, it matches up that we're often sometimes seeing people also bridge that gap a little bit with co-investments, particularly from their LPs. So, you know, I think new routes of financing, co-investments, let's see what the next few months hold for the mid-cap and the large-cap space.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to round off on that, I mean, we're seeing more and more co-investments on the direct lending side as well. It's quite common now for especially large cap lenders to bring in their LPs alongside them and give them slices through sidecars and other types of vehicles and give them access to some of these larger deals as well through the form of co-investments. So yeah, another interesting phenomenon that we're seeing unfold.
Okay, I think that's a good point to end the conversation. Thank you very much, Josh, for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thank you very much to all of our listeners at home. If you like the podcast, then please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also check out the Ion Analytics podcast channel on Apple Podcasts for more. See you again next time.